I have to tell you my favorite midterm story. Maybe one or two of you heard this before. The point of this is that you don't screw around with midterms because people put their game faces on. You're going to have your game faces on Monday. About maybe 10 years ago, somebody in the first half of this class raised their hand as, you know, the day before the lecture before the midterm and said, oddly enough, what language will the midterm be in? And this is before we had French-speaking sections. So, I mean, I don't know, you ask a question that was a fairly silly question, you give a fairly silly answer. So I said Croatian. So then I started thinking, well, I'll play a little joke on him. Ha ha, you know, don't screw around with midterms. And so I have a colleague who is Croatian, and so I made up the following question, which he translated into Croatian. And so the test, you come into the test and you get your basic piece of paper. It says answer one of the following two questions. And there's a third question in Croatian with a translation by Ivo Banac. And the question was mine. I take full credit or discredit for this. The question was, the population of Paris in 1831 was 630,721 people. Name these people. and in a second column, list those who own more than one apartment. So if you've got a question that said the population of Paris was 630,731, name these people, would you answer that question? Three people did. So you have to think, what have they been drinking? What have they been smoking? And so what do? I'm screwing around with a midterm, and we have three blue books answering question number three in Croatian, not responding in Croatian. That would be extra credit. And the first person says, well, I mean, logically enough, I mean, people must panic. I must have done this too when I showed up late for midterms or whatever, if I remember to go. You panic and you start writing. And the first person said, well, you know, Miramini's real interested in social geography. So wrote a pretty coherent essay about how the rich people live in the West, and the poorer people live in the East, and the wealthier people in the center, and the poorer people in the periphery. So I mean, so we graded that as a real answer. Person number two takes pen. I don't remember male or female. Person number two takes pen and starts writing a column. Albarizin, Jean-Claude. Albarizin, Jean-Marie. Albarizin, Xavier. And writes names, writes French names. Sitting there for 45 minutes writing names. What do you do with that? I call psychiatric services. I don't know. I get to say, I got to deal with this stuff. You know, And so the third person says, question number three. And then sort of just drooled all over the blue book for about the next half hour. You know, and so we get these things, get the soggy blue book, and you get one with a kind of a half-assed but still okay, you know, essay on social geography, and you get the third is a bunch of names. So how do you grade that? We had a meeting to discuss this, and I don't know what we did. I know we gave the first person some sort of B+ for the essay, number two, I think I convoked the person and maybe called the college dean to say, you know, ça va pas, ça marche pas, on a petit problème quand même, nous, voilà. Anyway, I didn't mean to screw around with your midterm. Sorry?
How many names did you get through?
Oh, it's about maybe, you know, I tore it up at the end. There was probably about, you know, 17 or 18 names, and they were in alphabetical order. So it wasn't that the midterm was a total loss, but that's the last time I screw around with midterms. So are your people getting this in French, the midterm, or in English?
Well, they're getting credit with the French department, should be in French.
No, but the exam, and we do the exam in a few minutes. Are we going to do that in French or?
Sure.
Okay. Voilà. So let's. Let's start. Where was I? I got taken out there a little bit here, thinking about those old times. I want today to talk about 1917 and 1918, and talk a little bit about the mutinies. the mutinies have to be seen in the context, of course, in all these assaults, but above all, the Battle of the Somme. And the Battle of the Somme, which began on July 1st, 1916, was the darkest moment, certainly in 4 years of dark days. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, I always give these statistics, but they're so interesting. The first day, 1st of July, 1916, almost 40,000 British soldiers were killed in one day. I mean, 40,000, sorry, were wounded, and 20,000 were killed on the very first day. There was a casualty for every half meter of the entire front line. So one casualty for every half meter of the front line. And I gave this statistic the first day when I was kind of giving an overview of the course, but there were more British soldiers killed or seriously wounded in the first 3 days of the Battle of the Somme than there were Americans killed in World War I, Korea, and Vietnam combined. And then you can include the 4,000 that have been killed in this current absurd war. And so, I mean, those are phenomenal losses. And so the question again, when you look at the poisoning of the political atmosphere and the absence of able leadership in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s, where were they? In the case of Britain, they were, as that poem went, hung up on that old barbed wire because they were dead. And you know, sometimes it's easy in a British society, such a class society, and it's easy to kind of poke fun at Oxbridge folks going to their common room and then going off to you know, machine gun Indian insurgents and this sort of thing. But the flower of British youth perished, and the flower of other countries' youth during this time. And so the mutinies have to be seen in that context, and I'll come back to them in a while. Now, 1917 is the crucial year, really, in determining the outcome of a war that seemed like it was going to go on forever. Forever, not defined by truly forever, but that in end of 1917 and beginning of 1918, into March 19, well, after they slow down the Ludendorff Offensive in 1918, the military planners begin to think that they'll win the war in 1920, 1921 maybe, if all went spectacularly well in 1919. And of course, there were, you know, as so many people died to win a few hundred meters or a kilometer or 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers at best, there were wags who said, well, at this rate, we'll reach the Rhine, somebody figured out, by the year 2007, which is where we are now, more or less, if I remember that statistic. But two things happened in 1917 that are essential. One is that the Bolshevik Revolution comes along. But first, the revolution in February, where the people of St. Petersburg wake up and find that the emperor has no clothes, that there's police but not troops, and the bread lines are long, and the czarist autocracy falls, leading to that sort of power vacuum and Kerensky's provisional government. And of course, in October, the Bolsheviks, after one attempt that failed, the Bolsheviks seize power. And at that point, the war changes dimensions dramatically in the east. Russia is still in the war until the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in March of 1918. But the propaganda, which was more than that, of war, bread, and peace, I mean, that's a motto to live by, means that you've got a de-acceleration in the Russian war effort, and you've got massive desertions from the Russian army. Now, one of the amazing things is that the desertion rate was so low compared to what you think would happen, and it is rather amazing that the Russians were able to hold on. Again, I mean, just as the Germans were close to Paris, particularly in March 1918, the German forces are also quite close to Petrograd, which Leningrad had been I mean, not Leningrad, that St. Petersburg had been renamed because Petrograd sounded more Russian. But the other thing that changes the outcome of the war is that the Americans come in. In the United States, the United States was supposedly neutral until 1917, but outside of places with strong German populations, for example, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Chicago, the majority of Americans supported the Allies as defined by the British, the French, and the Russians, and particularly through the British component. But it wasn't really that brings the Americans into the war. The German high command, to make again one of these interesting long stories very, very short, had decided that the only way that they could win is to knock the British out of the war. And the way that they could knock the British out of the war is to stop the supply of munitions, of food, of grain, of almost anything else you can imagine to Great Britain. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, the way you're going to do that is with a campaign of unrestricted submarine warfare, the famous U-boats, sink an incredible a number of ships. The German government sends representatives down to the docks in New York and to other ports, Boston and other places, and they put up warnings saying that civilian passengers or any other Americans who go on ships ought to know that they're entering a war zone and could be sunk. The German U-boats sink some ships with Americans on them. The most dramatic event was the sinking of the Lusitania, which I'm sure you all know about, in which lots of Americans, I can't remember how many, but it was hundreds and hundreds, it might have even been 1,000, I apologize for not having the statistic in my head, were killed I think it's fairly near Ireland. And of course the Americans go wild and say that this ship was carrying passengers going over to Britain and civilians, and this was an act of piracy, an act of war, an act of murder, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that, and I think it was the 1960s or 1970s, I vaguely remember this, that they sent divers down into the Lusitania, and they found that, as the Germans had claimed, was absolutely correct, that the Americans were, this ship was carrying munitions, and therefore, I mean, I'm not defending the sinking of the ship, I'm not for the defending, of the sinking of any ship, but clearly it was carrying weapons, and that's one of the reasons that the ship went down with such a dramatic impact, is because all the munitions blew up when the German torpedo hit it. But over the long run, what happens is that the man who was going to keep America out of war, Woodrow Wilson, former president of Princeton University, ends up taking the U.S. into war. And those of you who had American history from Glenda or other people, Glenda Gilmore or other folks here, will know that in the end, I mean, most Americans really didn't want to go to war. And Wilson, who was the first American president, by the way, ever to leave the United States during a term of office, goes to Versailles, to the Treaty of Versailles after the war, and then he can't get the treaty ever ratified by the U.S. Congress after that. I mean, his repudiation is really complete, unfortunately for him, at the end of the war. Now, what difference did the Americans coming into the war mean in 1917? It was not the troops. I mean, lots of troops begin to arrive, led by John Pershing, who had honed his skills by shooting down Mexicans in Mexico. They have the reputation for being sort of cowboys and earnest, and the typical American image is really, though that's been devastated in the last 4 or 5 years, but really is created by the Americans arriving to fight and well-trained pistol-wielding sharpshooters and all that. And they first fight at Chateau Thierry, which is not very far from Paris. It's northeast of Paris in 1917. But that's not what makes the difference. American troops in the long run will help tilt the scale to the Allies, and it compensates for what we've discussed in terms of the French not having, they're going to run out of soldiers. But the big difference is that the curves cross, that the curves of the ability of the Germans to supply their own forces, that the German war machine is not going to be able to compete with the combined power of American industrial might. and the Detroit can be easily converted. The factories in Detroit and Ypsilanti and Flint, Michigan, and lots of other places can be easily transformed into production of Ypsilanti, into the production of arms and places like that. And so the curves cross. And it's at that point when many people in in the French and the British high command, along with the Americans, they know they're going to win the war in the long run. But the question, at what cost? And the lively discussion, as there had been in Germany, over German war aims. The Germans, if they win the war in the West, they're going to want demand part of Belgium. They're going to want probably more of Lorraine, et cetera, et cetera. The French also have their war aims. They're going to want to have a permanent French presence. They're talking about that in the Rhineland, and as well as taking Alsace and Lorraine back. And so that helps set up, which I'll come back to talk about in a while, 1918, March, because that's when the Germans say, baby, it's now or never. And so that's the big Ludendorff offensive, which I'll come back to in March of 1918. That's important to say, to discuss at least a little bit. Now, what about the mutiny? And what about other aspects of the war? They have to do with the home front, and the mutinies are not on the home front, but they're quite close to it. As I said at the beginning, most people in France did not want war in 1914, but because it was easy to portray Germany as the aggressors, which they were, the vast majority of the population obviously was prepared to hold on because of the proximity, certainly of Paris to the front. And this is right through the war. It's right through into the failure of the Ludendorff offensive. Now, to be sure, there are tensions within French society about the war. There was tremendous resentment, and you can see photos of this resentment. In Paris, the opera was one place where they distributed coal that was rationed in order to have heat. And as you know from discussion previously of the Grand Boulevard, that's where many of the famous restaurants and cafes, the Café Américain, the Café La Paix, and ironically the Café de la Paix, the Café of Peace, and all those things are located. And so as people waited in line to hope to get a few chunks of coal in order to stay warm in these cold Parisian winters, they saw the fancy people in their big cars, driven by chauffeurs, going off to the great restaurants, and people who had profiteered from the war, and naming a war in which people do not profit enormously, and in which some aspects of big business are not just gleeful with every extended tour of duty, and you'll have discovered something that I didn't know existed. And so there's a lot of tension toward profiteers, to les gros, the big guys, the fat guys, les gros bonnets, the big hats. And you've got those tensions. But you have more than that, you have tensions between those people who, peasants, les paysans, who are conscripted without any real possibility, unless they've already had two brothers killed, and that saves them. And for example, skilled workers in the armament industry. For example, around Saint-Étienne is an armament manufacturing town, or was. They used to make bikes there too. Neither. They don't make either there anymore. Or in Tulle, in the Corrèze, places that make arms, people, skilled workers, got out of the draft because of that. And thus, they worked very hard, but there was, it was some tension towards that from for example, people in the Massif Central, where you have the most endless lists of names killed that one could ever see in Auvergne and places like that. So you have those sorts of tensions as well. Now, the role of women in all this is, of course, crucial, because it's in the factories, particularly in not highly skilled work, because they didn't have the formation or the training in that, that women step up and replace men. And also, again, the role of nurses is so important. And so that's why it was inconceivable for many French women, after all of this, not to get the vote after World War I, whereas in Britain, women get the vote after World War II. In the United States, Rosie the Riveter, you know, working in a factory in Detroit or in Pittsburgh, you know, became sort of an icon for, you know, sort of the crypto feminist movement in later decades. So you have some tensions there. I mean, you also had workers who would come back, and of course, after the war, if they were lucky enough to survive, Bruno Caban will probably talk about this next week, after a midterm, you know, they get thrown out. They're the last hired, so they're the first fired. And there's some tensions between males and females over that, too, because, well, the males had been out in the trenches, and they want those jobs back and all of that. But another thing that's rather interesting is, of course, the role of women in the nurses. And the big, you know, the northern French nuns and the Belgian nuns with those huge hats, and it was easy to become anti-clerical, and we've talked about that before. But one of the things that calms that situation is the role of the clergy, in particular of the female clergy, in attending to these horrible, horrible wounds, and in some cases going to the front, is, you know, working with ambulances and this sort of thing, as other women did who didn't happen to be nuns. And for example, the case of Lyon has been documented, and Lyon was the capital of the radical party with the big R, socially conservative but moderate politically, but built upon anti-clericalism. And in Lyon, where there was a vibrant kind of anti-clericalism before World War I, that calms down because, you know, these nuns who people attacked, representing in some ways the institutionalized role of the Catholic Church in French society, were extraordinarily heroic, and so were these priests and ministers and indeed rabbis who get killed by shells as they're giving the last rites to all these people who have been killed. And there's another tension too that's not talked about so much. But I've heard it in the collective memory of where we live too, is that one of the things that happens with the war, and obviously when you look at a map of France, that départements like the Ardennes and the Aisne and the Marne and the Pas-de-Calais and the Nord are basically German, or the front line is running right through that département. So you've got these millions of people who become refugees, and they are going, you know, they're in a more organized fashion than in 1940, when everybody's seen the pictures of them walking along the roads, carrying what they can, and then diving into the ditches as the German fighter plane, the German Air Force, is strafing them in a more organized fashion. But you still have to somewhere to go. You have to have some place to end up where you're going to be fed. And so where they end up? Well, they end up in the places in France where there's not fighting. And it became is that people get tired of the war by 1917. Well, they're tired. I mean, everybody's tired of the war. But as one gets even tireder of the war, you hear this sort of grumbling about these people from the north, and they speak a different accent. In some cases, if they speak German, they speak a different language. If they speak Flemish, and there are lots of Flemish speakers who come down from the north, from places like Hasbrouck, and all of that. And so. They are strains on local resources, which are already extremely limited. And so you even have this talk, grumbling. It's not more than that, but grumbling in cafes and bars about Paris's war, but also about les Boches du Nord, that is, the Germans of the North. And one of the things is that a lot of people in the north of France are blonde, and a lot of people, majority of people in the south of France, have dark hair. And so all of a sudden there's this arrival. This is a silly way of viewing it, but this is how people viewed it, is that, you know, you have blonde people in the south and you have dark people in the north. I mean, life is like that. But you have the arrival of these people, many of whom look like they're Dutch, you know, who are arriving and who cause some sort of a strain on the ability of communities to take care of those who are perceived as of their own. And so 1917 is a big year for that as well. You have other kinds of problems. You have 1917 is the year lots of men and women go on strike. Now these are not defeatist in quotes strikes, but the strikes in Saint-Étienne, and many of them are involving women, are demands for better working conditions, for better wages. They're part of the sacred union, l'union sacrée, but they want better conditions. And so the strikes in 1917, again, they're not defeatist strikes, they want to win the war, but it's the same thing as the movement before the war for better conditions. That why should you work for worse conditions than men, for example, or why should you work for conditions when the profiteers are getting rich and the gros bonnets, the big bonnets, the big hats are getting wealthy? Why should you have terrible conditions? And so these strikes, you know, are very widespread. Clemenceau, has more power in 1917. He becomes prime minister. He says, I wage war. That's all. There are attempts to break the strikes, but it's a year where the morale of the home front is extremely, it's fragile. It's more fragile in 1917 than any other time. And there seems to be this enormous disparity between this sort of howling propaganda of big newspapers in which everything is a great victory and defeats are just tiny setbacks, a step back. And if things are so damn good, why are the Germans still close to Paris? And so it becomes pretty hard to explain. Now, they don't have the problems that the Germans will have, because and that's a different situation. A very good book edited by my friend Jay Winter and Jean-Louis Robert called Capital Cities at War, because conditions are worse in Berlin than they are in Paris. But conditions are much better in London than they are in Paris, and that's for fairly obvious reasons, so the losses are still equally bad. So that year, 1917, is a bad year, but overall things are calmed down, and for these reasons I've already said, it is a turning point. Now, what about the strikes? What about the mutinies? How serious were the mutinies? There were probably only two divisions that were totally reliable standing between the Germans and Paris at that point. Not reliable, again, to the extent that they want the Germans to win, because they don't. But they want, for example, the rights of the French were trying to keep representatives from the Socialist Party from going to Switzerland or going to Sweden to meet in international peace conferences and that sort of thing. I spoke earlier, whenever it was, Monday, about this sort of discontinuity or the contrast between the soldiers' view of the war and that of the civilians. And one of the and how the soldiers back on leave didn't want to talk about it and couldn't really give that precise kinds of information anyway, because often it's all swirling around them and they don't really know what's going on in other places except where they are. But one of the best evidences of that is the fact that nobody, as far as we can tell, at the home front really knew at the time of the mutinies about how serious and widespread the mutinies were. That they didn't really know. Now, remember also that in fact, this is one of the key sources for Bruno Caban's magnificent book on Vic called the French translation in English would be something like "Victory Plunged into Mourning." That is the return of the soldiers. One of the principal sources are letters written by soldiers from the front that were collected and censored by military censors who don't want these letters revealing to civilians much of what's going on at all. And so that also explains why people at the home front really didn't know about how widespread these mutinies were, nor did the Germans, nor did the British outside of the high command have any sense of what was going on. Now, these mutinies, it's not too hard to say why these mutinies take place and when they do, or why they take place at all. It is not, again, defeatism. They don't want the Germans to win. They have some respect, lots of respect for the German soldiers they were fighting against, although at the end of the war, they still, this sort of, what seeps out of these letters, is maybe Bruno will talk about this next time, hatred for, the horrible Hun, et cetera, but is that, anybody could tell that these tactics were just killing hundreds of thousands of people for nothing, that there wasn't going to be a French-British breakthrough, that the Battle of the Somme grounds to a halt all along the front for obvious reasons,
after after a matter of really days, but weeks, and that there isn't any hope. It began when one company. Oh, by the way, how do we know this? We don't know it from Kirk Douglas. Most archives in France are can be opened up 50 years after the fact. So, what is year is this? 2000 something rather? 2007. So we could see the archives 50 years ago, but not 49 years ago. But with the military archives, because this was so sensitive, the mutinies, all of these documents were in the war archives in Vincennes. And I saw them before they were opened because I bribed my way in. Not to see them, I was working on something else, but the person that ran this, the war archive, was just totally clueless. And she'd leave for about 3-hour trysts or lunch breaks, I guess more appropriately. And then, and I knew these documents were there, and so I knew also somebody tipped me off that the gardien likes stamps, and so I would put all these wild sort of stamps on my mail letters when people still use stamps. And I had ones from Latin America and one from Africa, and this guy comes up, he says, very beautiful these stamps. I said, do you like stamps? and he, yes. Yes. Would you like these? Oh, thank you so much. And pretty soon I'm in the archives, in the back, And he's an officer too. He's some sort of lieutenant guy. He's a real good guy. Anyway, so I bribed my way in, and you could see these cartons, and they were chained. They were literally all chained in this big kind of capsule. It looked like a space capsule, except it was just looks like the basement of Brantford College or something. But you couldn't get into those because that was thought to be the national disgrace that there had been these mutinies, and the mutinies were indeed widespread. And so what happens is that refusals to go over the top simply spread. They spread like wildfire. Soldiers say they don't want to get killed anymore for 5 cents a day. In some places, there are red flags go up. In some places, there are black flags, which are the flags of anarchism. But remember that the socialists had also joined the Sacred Union, and that Jules Guesde ends up being minister of transport or minister of communication or something like that in 1915, if I remember correctly. And two regiments that are posted in Soissons. Soissons is not very far away from Paris. Soissons is about a 45-minute drive away from Paris by car now. Two regiments decide they're going to march on Paris to try to set things right. They're going to force the Chamber of Deputies to find a way to end the war. Not to say we want the Germans to win, but to find a way, get some sort of negotiated settlement so that this carnage stopped. Most of the generals, who are fairly clueless, see organized Bolshevik propaganda behind this, or pacifists, those people coming out of Sweden or Switzerland and trying to stop the useless way this war is being fought. In May and June, about 40,000 soldiers were involved in collective acts of refusal. Although the generals insisted in their correspondence that those 40,000 people were cowards, this obviously was not the case, and many of them had already been shot up and already been wounded and already were going back. The first signs of this, by the way, are that soldiers were supposed to move up in order to prepare to go over the top, began baaing like sheep, going baa, baa, the way that sheep baa on the way to the slaughter, l'abattoir, the slaughterhouse, because that's where they were going. Now, there was socialist and pacifist literature that had, happily enough, in my view, had gotten into the trenches, but this is not the motivation. And Pétain, who ends up being one of the sort of evil forces in France, but this was the early Pétain. When Pétain, he realizes that this is not the case. In fact, the repression is much less severe than many of the generals wanted. More about that in a minute. And so he ends the policy, Pétain does, of these mad attacks. Over the top, the whistles blow, and then they simply get slaughtered. In some areas, and we don't have exact statistics, because there were certainly some people who were just put up against the wall and shot, and we don't know. It's just like after 1945. We don't know. We have a guess of 10,000 people were killed in the reprisals in 1945, but that's a pretty rough account. There were 3,427 condemnations. About 10% of the people who faced some kind of court-martial for something they did or something they didn't do. And 49 were condemned to death, which is not, I'm not for condemning anybody to death. And these were carried out as in the movie, as in the film, immediately. You know, it's just up against the wall, bang, bang. And Pétain tries to bring in better conditions. I mean, ups the booze ration as well. And of course, that was pretty happy. In all, in fact, I said 40,000, but there's another statistic that goes as high as 70,000 people. Let me throw in a statistic as long as we're doing that. For strikes, instead, 1917, there were 689 strikes affecting 300,000 workers. That's a lot. 300,000 workers. And that's compared to 98 strikes in 1916. But again, a fascinating aspect I'm repeating is that this was not known, and this was not known, then you couldn't drive it in 45 minutes, but this was not known in Paris by the general population, what had happened. And in the end, France holds on. Now, in the spring of 1918, the Germans launch their victory drive, in quotes, the first major German offensive since 1914, before it's been the British and the French attempting to break through. Now, at the same time, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the army is, all the cracks that were quite predicted and predictable, there are all sorts of problems there, and Franz Josef has died in 1916, and so the Germans are quite unsure whether the Austro-Hungarian Empire is going to be able to hold on fighting against the Italians, for example, and remember the Brest-Litovsk is not signed until March of 1918. And the Americans have, by spring of 1918, 325,000 soldiers. That's not a huge number of soldiers, but that's still three times Michigan football stadium full. So that's a lot of people. So Ludendorff decides on a massive German assault along the poor old Somme River, therefore avoiding the mud of Flanders and avoiding the forts of eastern France around Verdun. He was encouraged by the fact that there are younger soldiers that are just barely 18 that have been put into the ranks, and he also has brought up much older men too. So they have some serious troops in order to try to pull off this breakthrough. And so on the 21st of March, 1918, after a relatively brief bombardment of 5 hours, as opposed to 5 days, 1.6 million men. Who could have imagined these numbers? Who could have imagined these numbers in 1913? 1.6 million men attacked the Allied defenses in five separate offenses over a front of 40 miles. And they do break through. In 5 days, some German units have pushed forward more than 40 miles. A complementary attack in Flanders does very well indeed. And the British troops and the French, as General Haig in Britain famously once said, were fighting with their backs to the wall. And on Easter Sunday of that year, again, the shells from Big Bertha lobbed all those miles from the north fall on Paris, the Rue de Rivoli. You can still see a sign where it took out an apartment building, Church of Saint-Gervais, you know, right near the Seine, the same thing. Boulevard Port-Royal, up by Montparnasse, the same thing. So these shells fall and they begin taking lives. But what happens was predictable and predicted, is that as on the small scale, in the big scale, the Germans begin to outrun their cover and supplies. And they begin at each one of these 5 points of German offensive to encounter stiff resistance. On July 15th, Ludendorff tries a last desperate attack, and it's repulsed. And for Ludendorff, he knew this was the last chance to win the war. And at that point, he knows it's la fin des haricots, the end of the green beans, that they're simply not going to win, and that the French, their resources swollen by the American entrance into the war, are not going to sue for an armistice until they pushed the Germans back across the Rhine. And at that point, morale plunges dangerously in Germany. In January of 1918, 250,000 German workers defy the government by going on strike. And strikes were illegal during the war. There's all sorts of hoarding, and so there's a big problem. And the French forces counter, or the Allies, the British, the French, and the Americans counterattack in July. And at this point, when they're in the open, for the first time, tanks, that you've all seen pictures of them stuck in the mud, now, but when they're in the open, tanks begin to work rather well, and they begin to adopt the strategy of having soldiers, infantry following tanks, and therefore not getting picked off, you know, in such huge numbers, and they begin to make a big a difference. On the 8th of August, 1918, the German army's darkest day, there are all sorts of attacks against the German lines, and a British force moves 8 miles. And that's a territory that was unimaginable in the beginning. At this point, Ludendorff tells the hapless Wilhelm II that it's all over but the shouting, and you better figure out some way of bringing this whole thing to an end. And as you know, in the end, Wilhelm II will slither across the Dutch border, and the armistice will be signed in a railroad car in Compiègne, north of Paris. There's still a railroad car there, it's not the same one, and that's where Hitler insisted on the declaration of the armistice in 1940 being signed. So the war ends on the 11th of November 1918. And as you know, there were many people, not many, but there were lots of people killed afterward because they didn't know that the armistice had come along, and that the biggest pandemic ever in human history, at least since the Black Death in the 14th century, the Spanish flu, as it was called, it probably started in India, but had already begun to sweep through the world. So things were not getting better and better, but they were getting worse and worse. Just a few, obvious statistics. I mean, you can see these all over, but it is staggering. Before I end with something that Jay Winter has begun one of his books with. And just in terms of dead and wounded, just a couple, you can write them down, but anyway, Russia, dead 1,800,000, wounded 5 million. Now that ain't nothing like World War II, 25 million dead in the Soviet Union in World War II. But 1.8 million is a rather lot to be killed. In France, the French, at least, and probably more than this, but you hear figures from 1.4 million to 1.5 million dead and wounded 4,266,000. Great Britain, including the Empire, the Dominion, the Australians, the Kenyans, dead 908,000 and wounded 2 million. The Italians, 578,000, excuse me, with about 1 million wounded. In Serbia, which is a very small country, dead 278,000, wounded 133,000. Tiny Belgium killed 38,000, wounded 44. And among the Central Powers, Germany, 2 million dead. After all that, you know, with your armies, how do you explain to the folks back home, all those people dead, why you've surrendered? Well, it must be someone's fault. And that's what the right would argue. It was the Jews. It was the socialists. It was the communists. There had to have been a stab in the back. How do you explain this to the folks back home? Wounded, 4 million, more than that. Austria-Hungary, the amazing thing is they held on so long, given all the national differences, 1.1 million with wounded 3.6 million. I mean, these are just statistics that are so incredible. In France, there are 36,000 communes, and there were only 12 that didn't have somebody killed. And that's where, when you go to any French commune, except those 12, you will see a list of those people killed. Or even inside churches, sometimes they'll have the parish ones. And if the war monuments are near the churches, that tends to happen more in areas that were still Christianized, where people still went to church. And I mentioned this once before, but if you go to the Bourbonnais or the Allier, you find these war memorials that are sort of like Voltaire, if God exists, how could he or she let this happen? With broken crosses, shattered crosses, that were lamenting that this could happen in a so-called civilized world. And of course, one thing that happens after the war, as Charles pointed out, you know, the other day, is that if you've been told, if you're an African or you're an Asian and you've been told that this is the great civilization, that the Europeans, they've got it all, you know, you've been told by them that they're better than you, how do you reconcile that to what they're screaming at you in their little schools, trying to teach you their language? If they're so damn better, how could they bring all of this upon Europe? There is, by the way, but one soldier left in Great Britain who's still alive from World War I. He's a fellow called Harry Payne. He was born in 1898, and somebody just published a book about him. And periodically, on Armistice Day, he is interviewed. You can hear him on BBC. But with the passing of time, of course, you don't have that anymore. And I can remember even my jeunesse. I can remember, you know, seeing these very aged people coming out on November 11th, so proud of, you know, of what they did, fighting, and, you know, and the Americans too that did. But in those days, those were different wars. And those were different countries, and I would argue also that was a very different America. Anyway, just to simply end with something that Jay Winter leaves us with, he has a wonderful book about mourning and memory. And he begins with a film. He begins with a film by Abel Gance. Abel Gance, G-A-N-C-E, did a very long and overrated film on Napoleon. With Napoleon, with the famous snowball fight, but he did a book. He takes Zola's title, but he did a movie called J'accuse. He makes it in 1918 and 1919. He made it before the war is over. The hero is a guy called Jean Diaz. He's a wounded soldier poet, and he goes crazy. He begins to lose his mind, as so many people that did after all that in World War I. He escapes from a mental hospital. And he goes back to his village, and he brings all the villagers together, and he tells them about a dream that he's had in the asylum. And in the dream, in the movie, you see a battlefield graveyard with all the crosses. They're all there, and they're all askewed, and a big black cloud comes up behind the village graveyard in the movie. And magically, these ghost-like figures emerge from the graves with tattered bandages, missing arms. Their bandages begin to unravel around their head. And some are blind, they've lost their sight, and some are coughing out their lungs from the poison gas. And they leave the battlefield, and they go back to their own villages to see if the sacrifices have been worth it. And what they find is what Jay calls the pettiness of civilian life, that the black marketing, the profiteering, their wives have been sleeping around, things aren't the way they should be, whereas they have suffered. But they come back. They're alive again, but they're really dead. And their appearance so terrifies the villagers that they decide to mend their ways and to become better people. And so these ghost-like figures in their bandages, they march back to the cemetery, and they go back into their graves, and it's all over. But what's really interesting about it is that some of the soldiers who were on leave at that time, en permission, were used as extras in the movie, and you can identify them. Someone who has lost his arm, really, it's not a fake missing arm, it's a real one. And some of them who were there in the movie go back to the war and are killed. They die, real deaths, in their graves with their tattered bandages. And as if art and reality has merged. And that's an important theme in all of this, because there's no war, no more powerful moment in history that has brought us such great literature in all of this. And there's no war like this ever that unleashed so many demons into the world. And this is some of those demons that we will now next turn, but not today. Good luck in the midterm. Have a great weekend. Rock and roll.